Yeah, so you had this state of Franklin. So basically after the Revolutionary War, after American independence, we didn't really know how to define a state. And for lack of a better term, it existed. It actually, for 4 years, it was a functioning state.
The state of Franklin.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur, and I'm joined by Eric Mason, the brilliant loose cannon economist who brings a wealth of knowledge and the wildest of historical facts to the table. Last time we were here, we looked through some of the crazy economic policies and other just wild events that kind of happened during Washington's tenure. Wasn't just as simple as Declaration of Independence and then go to town, right? It looks like there's a lot of resistance to a lot of what they were trying to do, which I thought was actually kind of surprising.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly always a counterbalance to it all. It's kind of like modern politics, right? Like,
yeah,
a successful president, 45% of people don't like him.
Right.
Yes, I think we definitely saw that a lot. But this type of episode is kind of, I think, going to be one of my favorite ones throughout the series. And 100% Kyle's idea was to let's take a step back, look at what's going on around the presidency. So hopefully I'm going to try and get some really weird reactions from Kyle throughout this entire time. I had so many to pick from.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sad because we'd be a 9-hour show if I went through every single one of them.
Well, I suppose you could just start going down the list and I'll just cut you off when it's time.
All right. So here we go. I hope it's immediate. Like, dude.
Right.
All right. So let's start with what I think is one of my favorite ones, which is the state of Franklin. So
the state?
Yeah. The state of Franklin.
There was a state. Franklin.
They tried to make a state of Franklin.
Okay, you're right. Yeah. Objective met.
Yeah.
I've never heard this before.
Yeah. So the state of Franklin, it was really funny. So when the war ends, we talk about the 13 colonies, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what the 13 colonies are. But what's funny is when you talk to people, is Maine one of the 13 colonies?
No.
No, it's not, because it didn't become a state until 1820 with the Missouri Compromise. Is Vermont one of the 13 original colonies? It's like,
no. It was part of New Hampshire at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was part of New Hampshire. It was just like, it was weird. It was kind of its own country, but then also you had, it's Ethan Allen.
Why did the U.S. get foreign, but Canada got left behind as a territory? Why didn't we take them with us?
So the Articles of Confederation actually had a clause that Canada could join at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But Canada was just so depopulated. It was so empty. And then it was like, they didn't know if they were French. They didn't know if they were British. And then like the obviously
Russian, even for a little bit.
Yeah, just wild in general. And it was just so empty. It was basically seen as a giant resource depository. And again, I'm talking about from the Western European side. Obviously, First Nation individuals have a much different history with that. But, mm-hmm. In terms of Western colonialization, it was a little different. Yeah, but yeah, it's very funny. So, Canada could have just been like, yo, we're joining you?
Yeah. And they would have been number 14.
Yeah, it would have been sick if we were just the U.S. and Canada, which is the largest country on Earth. Biggest economy on Earth. So the state of Franklin. So we all know there's been all these weird states, right? Like quasi states. You had Deseret, which is was a state the Mormons tried to find when Brigham Young went out there.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so there's a state. I've always heard it pronounced Deseret, but I want to be careful because that could be one of those words that like.
Dude, I grew up Mormon. I feel like I should have known that.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, kind of became Utah, but like, I'm not supposed to say it became Utah. Imagine Utah, but like. Not sharp lines, just like a bunch of like a giant circle.
No.
like if you give it to Google sometime, you'd be like, what the heck was this place? Then you had the state of Jefferson, which is, I believe, like California.
Mm-hmm.
That was a weird one because California has gone through a couple iterations of trying to be split up into three separate states.
There recently was a movement to try to split it into five now, wasn't there?
Was it five? I know there was, I don't know if it was a ballot measure, but I saw there was like some political pressure going on out there to do that.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have Oregon, who has like half the state wants to join Idaho and create greater Idaho.
What did you call it?
Oh my God. This is the second. I got made fun of this yesterday. I called it Oregon.
That's the proper way to pronounce it, but I think nobody does it. So yeah. You sound like a lunatic when you do.
A lunatic with your properly Oregon. Pronouncing words. How dare you go to speech therapy? Jerk. So you had this state of Franklin. Of all the proposed states that ever existed, that we're going to exist, like Deseret and Jefferson, it was probably the most legitimate one of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So basically after the Revolutionary War, after American independence, we didn't really know how to define a state. Well, the Carolinas were still more, North Carolina in particular, was still more or less a very awkwardly shaped territory. Now, it's important to remember that all the colonial charters basically existed from the East Coast to the West Coast, more or less, in a straight line of the width of the state.
Yeah, that's why they got those straight lines, because they were based off of latitude lines, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So as this war ends, you have these people in Carolina who wanted to form their own state. It's technically in modern-day Tennessee. It's kind of in like the northeast corner of Tennessee, but it was part of North Carolina at the time. And for lack of a better term, it existed. It actually, for 4 years, it was a functioning state.
The state of Franklin.
Yeah. It was never, it never ascended to, like, through Congress, mm-hmm. because by this time, it eventually got rolled into Tennessee. It's so interesting because what basically happens, you have the state, it gets formed, it gets recognized, it kind of self-declares its existence. Congress doesn't recognize it, but it's still, at this point, I mean, Congress is way over there, sitting over in the corner. This is prior to the adoption of the U.S. Constitution. So how much can the federal government, or in this case, the national government, because it's Confederacy, really mm-hmm. go down into North Carolina and tell some people in the North Carolina territory claim that they're not a state if everybody else acknowledges you as a state? So eventually, like, after existing for four-ish years, you end up having the American Constitution rolls around. I think they were a little nervous that they were going to be part of the Constitution, like the definition of the United States. And they were like, oh, that'd be really bad for us. We'd be this like tiny, like half dozen counties, and there'd be an entire country.
How big was it?
It was like 12 counties.
Like, oh, Jesus.
Think of Tennessee. Or, you know, Tennessee is like a polygon.
Yeah.
All right, just like chop off the little triangle on the right side. That's pretty much where.
Just basically where Knoxville is.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah.
Okay. So it's basically Knoxville.
Yeah, it's like super Knoxville. So they end up getting absorbed back into North Carolina, and then eventually become modern-day Tennessee once the state of Tennessee forms. But it raised this like really interesting question, because being a state's a big deal, right? Like, mm-hmm. you get electoral colleges. And they weren't going to give 12 counties two senators and a rep. Like, that's insane. right? Like, hey, you 12 people who live here, you now have the voting power of the
New
entire
York,
state of New
Pennsylvania.
York.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I think that really becomes, I really think that's a indicative of kind of the early economics of the United States, where there was this strive and this desire for fierce independence at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
But this pragmatic reality that the federal style of government has the best economic outcome. So the ability to freely trade between states, and that benefit of being a state within a federal system, being a less powerful unit in a much more powerful system, is better than being a powerful unit in a weak system.
Yeah.
Eventually, even the southern states that were very pro state rights saw that.
Well, I mean, if you just think about it, I mean, the federal government, it takes a lot of responsibilities off of your plate and allows you to focus on the things that you can actually control.
Yeah. You know, it does other ways. Absolutely. And it's so interesting because of how different states are. Mm-hmm. I mean, Massachusetts is so different than, you know, Wyoming. And then California is so different than Alaska. It's like, it is amazing how we all kind of work together. And I think a lot of the stuff that Washington did up front helped that. He was mm-hmm. a person who represented a cause that we rallied behind.
And I think it probably would have been a lot different, too, if he was a noble birth.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, we probably wouldn't have the same sort of appeal as the everyday man, like just a farmer who just rose up and decided that he was going to lead a nation.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
He was Cincinnatus. He was mm-hmm. that. And but
is that why they named Cincinnati that?
Yeah, it's named after Cincinnatus.
Okay.
So Kyle, I want to tell you, I want to bring up, and I've told you before, I want to bring this up, and I have been telling people I work with, I've been telling my friends how excited I am to record this episode this week, because I get to bring up one of my favorite economic revolutionary period early American history things to ever happen that I don't think is taught in schools at all. The Yazoo land scandal.
See, now the name Yazoo sounds familiar, but I don't know anything about what you're talking about here.
So, like, it comes out in 1795. It was probably going on long before. Probably went on long afterwards. So a bunch of these dudes in Georgia legislators, like, so Georgia had this huge claim that essentially, like, for all intents and purposes, yeah, it went across the entire country. But from, like, actionable land area, it was really, like, Mississippi and Alabama.
Yeah.
Because you get to Louisiana, like, Louisiana is part of, you know, obviously.
That's the French holdings, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so the British could draw that line all the way to the West Coast, but doesn't mean anything. So a bunch of Georgians got together, and they were like, we could make a lot of money if we sell this land to, like, either ourselves or to, like, our friends. And so all these Georgia state legislators took bribes and sold land for, like, nothing in Alabama. It ended up being, like, the first real big American scandal. I mean, there's certainly other scandals that existed before, but this is the first one that was, like...
elected U.S. officials?
Yeah, like, just taking bribes from their buddies to sell the state of Alabama. And I really do think that's why Alabama and Georgia to this day don't like each other.
I think it's more than that.
It was just, like... The funny part is that the sheer audacity of it is kind of what I found very funny, because it wasn't like they had this grand conspiracy where they're like, hey, you know what we're going to do is we're going to sell this land for slightly less and our buddies are going to develop on it and farm it and they're going to give us kickbacks. They were straight up like, I'm going to sell you this land for like a dollar and it's worth like $50 million and could you just hand me cash? They're like, yeah, sure.
Was there anything that prohibited that kind of contact yet at this point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, there's, there's all these, like, rules and stuff about, like, it's essentially, like, what we call modern-day conflict of interest. Yeah, you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't profit from something you vote on, effectively, or directly.
So they did have some sort of guide rails in place. This wasn't just a bunch of people who were like, yeah, there's nothing says we can't. All right, yeah, you go ahead and buy it.
I believe they used to call it uttering.
What is it?
Uttering. U-T-T-T-E-R.
Uttering.
It's like fraud. It's like essentially, it's fraud for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
So they didn't really have a plan after, like, it was like, you ever see the South Park episode? It's like step one.
Yes.
Step two. underpants. Step two. Step yeah. three. Profit. They didn't know what to do. So they just gave the money. So you end up with like all these Georgia legislators getting filthy rich, like insanely rich. And you get all this uneconomic land. These purchases weren't to develop Alabama, what's in modern-day Alabama. I just want to be really clear. This wasn't something that was like, hey, they gave Johnny a discount on the on the land, but he's going to, you know, employ a bunch of people, and they're going to build all this nice stuff. I want to be clear about this. This is straight-up just speculation. This is just straight-up, like, a bunch of guys got together, bought all this land, with the hopes that they'd one day be able to sell it. So that actually proved, like, a little bit challenging. But once this is all resolved, and as Alabama statehood and population started getting growing enough to where it could be, you know, converted over to a state, that took several decades. But even to this day, you can actually look at where these land deals happened, and they're economically more depressed because it was never this idea of developing the land. They were just like giving it to their, it was cronyism. They were just giving it to the
people. Really? There's still, you can still see the effects of that decision?
Yeah, you can still see the effects of the Civil War too, economically down there. It's kind of wild.
That is insane.
Yeah, so it's very funny because I often wonder what Washington never really commented on it. I often wonder like what George Washington would have thought about, like what he really thought when he read this. Do you think he was just like, guys, I'm trying to save the boat from sinking. Can you stop poking holes in the hull?
Right. I'm surprised he didn't show up there with the troops the same way he did the Whiskey Rebellion. That's something like that, undermining the faith of a new government. That's kind of a big deal.
How great would it have been if every time he disagreed with somebody, he just marched an army?
Showed up with an army?
Listen, I love the guy, but every time it's a saber on a horse, I'm just like...
Right.
He seems to be.
I think we should be a little bit more fair to him. That's not what he did, but it would be hilarious.
That's not what he did.
What did end up happening to those guys, though?
I mean, it was a mixture of restitutions, buyback, dismissal of contracts.
Do those people still own that land, or do they get it taken away from them at least?
So, largely no, but are you able to figure out everybody who was involved in everything? Some of the land was legally sold, so I really don't want to make it sound like it was
right.
Like they made up their own system. But what's funny is last episode we talked about the Panic of 1792. Mm-hmm. And while the Yazoo land scandal really came to a front in 1795, something that I found kind of funny-ish. I don't want to say funny because that makes it sound like I'm enjoying this, and I'm not, because I don't I don't want to make it sound isn't it wicked funny? A bunch of Georgians sold Alabama land.
As you're laughing gleefully.
As I'm laughing gleefully. But part of the Panic of 1792, which was this huge bubble, this huge land bubble, mm-hmm. predominantly in the South. So basically the Panic of 72, like we talked a little bit about last show, was driven a lot by stock market speculation, non-standardization of stock receipts, and so on. But that was mostly a northern issue. In the South, it was some depressed trading. Mm-hmm. It was some international competition because, you used to be on, in the same nation that owned Barbados, your biggest competitor for, certain cash crops, and now you're competing with them. So that obviously changes a little bit.
Right.
The U.S. still exerted a lot of pressure from, the fish trade during that time period. So I don't want to act like the U.S. was completely defenseless in a trade war. It had some ammo. But it was more porcupine than shark in that case. And so you had this huge bubble that burst in 1792 that's heavily based on land speculation. And Washington and his cabinet do a hell of a job trying to wrangle it. And they're doing their best. Because don't forget, every single time they do everything, somebody is trying to sue them or basically say that, not sue them, but challenge the constitutionality of what they're doing.
Right.
Poor Rudolph, the A.G. Rudolph, is doing his best to, try and keep everybody together when it comes to the Constitution and staying in line. You have
trying to explain legal arguments to somebody with an 11th grade reading level.
Yeah, somebody who whose first way he wanted to address an issue was to raise an army and go defeat it.
Right.
Which I can imagine Rudolph just being like, listen, I know what you want to do, but you can't beat the financial panic into submission militarily. Oh, yeah, well, who hasn't?
Who do I shoot?
So this all happens. And then 3 years later, they discover that all these Georgians are selling off land. It's guys, what are you doing? We're trying to fix this. You're over there speculating more on land. It's like, we needed money. It was a recession. So it's like, what? So what's really funny is that they also own land in Georgia, in Alabama too, right? Technically that's part of Georgia's claim. But Mississippi is very weird because Mississippi has this crazy French influence. I bet there's a place to be argued that it was more French than it was British. And certainly an argument goes more French than it was, colonial or at the early American history. One of the first bubbles in U.S. history, in world history, or at least in European history, and we have data to observe it, is the Mississippi land bubble, where basically there was a company formed that sold off land in Mississippi to a bunch of rich and artisan and aristocrat level in mm-hmm. France. And they just drove up the land value of a bunch of land nobody's seen. I don't know, Kyle, have you been to Mississippi?
Yeah, I used to live there for a couple years, yeah.
Would you describe Mississippi as plush rolling plains of easily manageable land?
I mean, my experience was more in the northern side of it. It actually was pretty nice, but you go further south and that's not, no.
Yeah, so at the time, when Ponce de Leon was searching for the Fountain of Youth, it was cruising mm-hmm. around Mississippi. It was just the swampland. That's where the speculation was.
So it's Florida land from later in our history.
Mississippi is a beautiful state. Northern Mississippi is absolutely beautiful. Yeah, it's definitely, as you get into that kind of, as you push more towards the inland of the southeast, I guess I would call it, absolutely beautiful mm-hmm. area. Yeah, but this is they were speculating swampy mud land and kind of telling it was great farming land and you'll get a bunch of beavers and stuff on there. You won't.
So Wait a minute. You said that was one of the first bubbles ever recorded. Did that predate the tulip?
It's the tulip is the first we have a modern, but it's okay. Only beats it by a few decades.
I was gonna say that sounds like they were probably pretty close in time.
Yeah. Because people like started having money and they were like, oh, how can I invest in things? And everybody's like, you should buy a bunch of AMC stock. I mean, you should buy a bunch of tulips.
Right.
This is a band of traders, Eric.
I know, right? Should have said GameStop.
Yeah, I was going to say.
All right. All right.
Yeah, so it is. Yeah, so it's funny because it's. They already knew this happened. This is like living memory. We already knew the speculation happened, and it crippled that whole area of Mississippi economically.
And then how long later?
Yeah, you had like one generation later, and these dudes ran it back. They were like, yeah, let's do this again. And that's the thing I love about economics. It's all human nature. One of the other interesting things that happened, and Washington was involved in this, but he didn't directly serve in the negotiations of it, obviously because of, you know, it's hard to... You know, you couldn't really send a telegram at that time and make a phone call. What's the Jay Treaty? The Jay Treaty was kind of really, really interesting. So both the U.S. hated the Jay Treaty and the Brits hated the Jay Treaty.
What was the Jay Treaty?
So after the war ended, you had the Treaty of Paris that essentially ended the Revolutionary War. That ended the hostilities. Mm-hmm. And kind of set apart that like the Brits weren't going to, you know, restart the war. We weren't gonna start a war with the Brits.
Is that the one that stopped them from pressing our people into service whenever they captured our ships?
That's impressment. That's War of 1812 that was caused by Ghent that ended that one. War of 1812, as I've said in previous episodes, is gonna be one of the funniest ones.
Yeah,
it's just such a cool war. The first time explosive shells were used. You know. We had two capitals of two different nations burnt down. And then it just ended. Everybody's like, oh, cool. And then it ends, and some like really angry dude decides to have a massive battle in New Orleans, and that somehow makes him become president. Fascinating time. Which, I don't know about you, but when I learned about the War of 1812 in school, we like glossed over it.
All of it. Yeah. It was basically the whole point of that... being taught that was the moment that kind of put us on the world stage, they say. That's what kind of was the turning point for the relations with Britain, too.
Yeah, you're going to discover my very pro-British leanings throughout this podcast series.
Right.
So the Jay Treaty kind of cleaned up everything that was left on the table from the previous treaty. And it was fascinating what it did. Because the idea of a former colonial power negotiating with that former colony was so unprecedented. It was such a thing the Brits had no idea how to do. A lot of the Brits didn't even think they should attend the meetings.
Was this the first time the Brits had lost a colony?
To the colony itself?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I believe this is the first time. Yeah.
Not to be taken by another power, but to actually overthrow the government and to launch their own.
Yeah. And what's crazy to think about this, again, we tend to look at history very static, the history being very flat. All these events happen so close together in time, and they all seem so far away that it all happened. The JT Treaty was signed 20 years after hostilities started in the Revolutionary War. They were signed almost to the day, I believe almost to the day after the shot, 20 years after the shot heard around the world.
That was 1776 when it started?
1775 was a shot around the world. Declaration of Independence, 1776.
But then we're talking about his first term was, what, 88?
1788, yep. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, so there's a lot of time in between that just kind of gets glossed over.
Yeah, I was teaching the youth and government class one time, and I was talking about the time between things. I was actually talking about the time between the end of the Vietnam War and the fall of Hanoi. Because when I teach in government, I always do what I like to do once a month. I do contemporary U.S. history because kids love contemporary U.S. history because they don't get taught it. And I was explaining, like, you know, you had Linebacker 2, ends Vietnam War, peace treaty gets signed, fall of Hanoi is 3 years later. And one of the kids said, well, that's really close. Why aren't they the same event? I said, hold your breath for 3 years. He was like, what? I go, hold your breath for 3 years. It's close in time. I don't know. It's like 3 years is a long time for something to happen. Now imagine 12 years or 20 years. There's a whole generation of people. And now you're trying to fix essentially what were the remnant lands and remnant rights that existed after the Revolutionary War, after the Treaty of Paris is signed. Britain didn't know how to act with, like, a new nation. They didn't understand, like, you're now a nation. It's almost like when you're a parent and your kid moves out and now your kid makes their own decisions and goes their own way.
No, it's more like your kid moves out and goes, does his own thing, but then comes back 3 years later and sues you. Like, you owe me college, buddy.
It's funny because it's not like the U.S. became, it wasn't like the aftermath of the Revolutionary War from an economic standpoint caused this cataclysmic economic collapse. It caused an economic depression, but not an economic depression unexpected for a large-scale war like that.
Well, how much of it was the war and how much was it just the disruption of all of the protections of trade comes with that came with having a colonial power oversee us?
Kyle, exactly. Yeah, that is the question. And I gotta say, I'm an economist, so I'm gonna, you know probably where I'm going with this. I agree with you on this. It's institutions and safety of free navigation of the seas when you're an export-based economy.
Right. Especially when you're a new world that has an ocean between you and every other established market in the world.
Yeah. But what eventually happened is that your economics can heal a lot of wounds because they still needed the cod. They still needed the tobacco. They still needed the indigo. They still needed the rice.
The wood.
So trade, took up again. And if you're a regular British citizen, what do you care more about? Owning a land that brings no benefit to you, and now you have higher prices for your rice or for your clothes that use cotton, or would you rather just have the lower prices for everything?
Yeah,
because you're making money off the New World.
Yeah.
Right, it's pretty easy. Even dictators and monarchs are, subservient to the people to some degree. So America was like already starting to hum along and started to be pretty economically potent. It was still, one of the most populated areas in the New World. Britain didn't want to see them become best friends with the French or the Spanish. There were still other colonies to balance out. It was really, really cool to look at, as we do research for this podcast, is to look at kind of what those primary sources and those contemporary decisions and opinions are of that time period. The British just felt like they were negotiating with a kid. Like, they were like, listen, we've been a nation under one constitution for, at that point, probably 500-600 years with the Magna Carta.
When was the Magna Carta? Was
1215.
And then before that, he had Roman influences, and they've been around. They've got quite the history.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, they've essentially been their own functioning nation probably since the fall of the Roman Empire. It's probably around 410, or the fall of the Western Roman Empire. But yeah, it is fast. So now they're dealing with this new country that, and there's still a lot of Brits there who blame Cromwell and basically said he was bad at his job and all this stuff. We should have taken them back. There's still a lot of pride. But it's 20 years later. Those soldiers, those generals, those politicians who fought the American Revolution probably aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always culturally looked down on the United States. And now you have the Jay Treaty. You got to sit down and work out what's probably some very bland details, like working out the Anglo-Adams border dispute up in modern-day Maine, which still didn't get solved for a while.
Mm-hmm.
How does trade work between the two nations? It's a very interesting economic forces going along, but mixed in with a culture that just didn't respect their other one's right to be anything more than British citizens.
What was our, the American point of view of negotiating with Britain? Was that more of like, we just kicked your ass and you're going to recognize us? Or like, do we have a little bit of swagger when we're trying to walk into those meetings?
Honestly, no, because a lot of the guys negotiating the treaty who were, there was definitely swagger. Like, don't get me wrong. There's definitely a little bit of swagger going in there. But the big part of the Jay Treaty was they wanted to get back to normal.
Yeah.
They wanted to get the country going in the right direction. They wanted to be able to have normalization of trade, normalization of international relations. I mean, what's important to remember is that John Jay, who is where the Jay Treaty comes from, is one of the gentlemen who wrote the Federalist Papers. I mean, he's an avid Federalist. He is someone who believed in the sovereignty and ability, not just of the United States, but he was generally a large supporter of the concept of, you know, popular sovereignty for all nations. So you sit there as you're negotiating with this guy, you're negotiating with a very, very prominent American, but it's not George Washington, it's not, right, you know, Benjamin Franklin. You're negotiating with basically a philosoph who categorically even disagrees with the concept of a monarch. So it probably felt kind of weird.
It's like it's like being a 50-year-old negotiating with a college kid.
Yes, but the college kid just kicked your ass.
Yes, yes. And you're feeling a little bit embarrassed.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that John Jay isn't, I described him as this like guy who believed in popular sovereignty. He was pro-British. He was pro-British. Like, that's why so many of these guys exist in this weird world where they believe in sovereignty. They believe in a republic.
But they still love their, basically, they still see themselves as Britons.
Yeah, exactly. It's they were Brits who, I think, if you had asked them, hey, do you know what, we're going to go to republic, or you guys are going to have equal footing with your fellow Brits, that probably would have caused a lot of problems, because some of them probably would have wanted to do it.
Probably a lot, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because Jay went over there. He had no real, not leverage in a lot of stuff. His big thing they had was that, Kyle, you mentioned earlier that the whole issue with impressment and didn't really get solved till the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. Like, the Brits were still doing that, but they were, now that they didn't have free navigation of the seas, they were, you know, I don't want to say privateering, but kind of privateering.
Yeah. State-sponsored piracy was kind of a big deal during this whole period, wasn't it? The golden age of piracy.
Yeah, exactly. So the Brits were kind of nervous because at the time, the Swedish and the Danish were basically going around and challenging the whole concept of a neutral status registry for ships.
Mm-hmm.
And what that basically meant is that ships that England currently wouldn't say, hey, we're going to seize you, if you were flying a flag of that nation, you were allowed, you were supposed to get safe passage. And what happened is that, like, the Swedes and the Danes, their ships kept getting accidentally right, seized. Now, the whole issue of impressment really wasn't that prominent now. It still happened, and I don't want to make it sound like, oh, it never happened, but it wasn't really the top of the card. It was really this whole thing of, like, seizing these goods and stuff.
Yeah.
And so John Jay went over there, and he's trying to create leverage, so he was just like, we'll join the Danes and the Swedes in, like, challenging this neutrality, which England was feared that it was going to start a war. England's like, wait, what are you talking about? What? I thought we were negotiating, like, the... They were just like cleaning up some of the Treaty of Paris, but
right.
What are you doing? like, just out of the blue.
Kind of blindsided him a little bit there, huh?
Yeah, and I don't believe the Swedes or the Danes knew John Jay was trying to get involved in this.
That's even better.
And it's funny because, like, the big impetus for why the Jay Treaty was so need to be negotiated so quickly, instead of, like, you know, sometimes you see negotiations take, you know, because it was negotiated over a pretty relatively abbreviated time frame, is because in the Treaty of Paris, the Brits were supposed to leave all these, like, forts that they had occupied, and so they left them. And the U.S. didn't want a standing army, mm-hmm, so they never occupied them.
Oh, great.
So the Brits, like, paid a bunch of Native Americans to occupy them. And then they occupied them. And then America's like, dude, what are you doing? And then there was incidents of, like we talked earlier, impressment that happened. But one of my favorite things is that then the Brits got angry because basically we were like, hey, can you get out of the forts you explicitly said you weren't going to go to? That'd be, like, super cool. I'd appreciate that.
Right.
The Brits were like, how about no? And they flooded. They were like really, really nervous of, like, U.S. Like, the U.S. started to, once it started to cover the Revolutionary War, its economy started really booming.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. had such powerful export power. Like, so crazy. It had tons of great port facilities. It had the ships.
So much coastline.
Right.
River systems.
It's impossible to embargo blockade coastline.
Right.
They were scary. They basically viewed us the way, like, China is viewed by some politicians today as kind of this, like, you know, factory that can produce things. It's, you know, different with the U.S. at this time point. It's the U.S. is also paying the people producing things, and they're getting wealthy also, as opposed to just subsidizing them. So the British response to this was to flood the U.S. market with British exports from around the kingdom.
Really? How'd that work out?
Not well, not super well, because the U.S. was like, oh,
cheap goods. We'll just go sell them over here then.
Yeah, it caused, exactly, it caused this, like, what do you call it, cyclical effect, and you ended up with, like, the U.S. buying cheap stuff and then driving it up, horsing it up to Canada and selling it to Brits. Because of entrepreneurialism.
Right. Oh, God.
Like, all the stuff I've ever read about George Washington, all the stuff I've read about going on this time period, the fact that Jay Treaty gets glossed over in history books, and, you know, and again, you can only teach so many things in school. I don't want to criticize anything there. I think it's great because I find very funny because it is a great time talking about it, because the U.S. was like, hey, thanks for all the free stuff, and started flooding every British place with cheap American goods.
I freaking love that.
And the Brits were like, don't do that. So they started putting tariffs on them. And the U.S. was like, oh, that like kind of stinks. But, like, I guess we'll keep trading with, like, the Danes and the Swedes and the Spanish and the Portuguese. And, like, at this point, like, you know, Grand Colombia wasn't really a country yet. But you start seeing a huge population concentration down there. So they're just, like, going around doing their business. And the Brits, that's when the Brits started that whole, like, neutral flag. And you started seeing an increase in impressment. And the Americans are just like, dude, what do you want from it? Like,
right.
Yeah, so towards, like, just before, it was, like, probably the last year in Washington's presidency. There was this big scandal where a bunch of British war vessels seized a bunch of Americans and American cargoes at some ports. Basically, like, I don't know what the trumped up charges were, but they're basically saying, like, they were circumnavigating tariffs, which I'm kind of confused on how you, like, is that a customs? Like,
how do you do that at the sea before you get to the place that the tariff is supposed to be imposed?
Yeah, it feels weird. That's a weird one. Yeah. So they were going to go to war. They were about to go back to war. But remember, all those Brits had occupied all these forts and stuff up and down there. But it was a little risky for the old British monarch, because, like, what if I get my ass handed to me again?
Right.
Like, if I can't lose a second time. And at this point, the prices in England started rising because they were, tales all this time, tariffs, the other country never pays for the tariffs. It's all who demands it most. So all these prices start going through the roof. Like, in England's like, yo, dude, like, what, I'm very confused here. I was getting all my cheap stuff from America. It was going swell. I was super pumped about that. And now everything's expensive. And
now the Americans are sending me my goods back to me.
That's what's happening. And they're like, and I can't make any money selling my stuff I've been selling for like 100 years to the colony, to what were formerly the colonies, because they're angry at me also. So, why am I the only person getting screwed?
What's the game plan?
So, George Washington's like, guys, like, can we not do this? Like, seriously, like, this is the dumbest thing in the world. Like, nobody's making any money on this. We got a bunch of British troops over there. They're chilling over there. But this is like this is like 1790s, right? This is 1790s. England doesn't have a lot of friends right now. And you have a whole continent that's half freaking France and the other half Spain. All right. Spain's a dying empire at this time point. That's the most dangerous animal.
Yeah,
you have Spain. Spain's a Spanish colony right now, who's fought protracted wars with the Brits. They fought the Seminole Wars against the Brits. You know, Spanish, that was not us. That was the Seminoles with muskets. Like, what? Saint Augustine. I wonder what country founded Saint Augustine. So let me look at it.
Yeah, a lot of Florida was all Spanish, yeah, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Even their flag to the day looks like it has Spanish influences. So, George Washington's like, what do we do here? Like, we got to figure this out. And, you know, France isn't this big, powerful ally now, but it's still a threat. So, he goes to his cabinet. We talked to his cabinet last. And so, as you know, Kyle, you need to negotiate a treaty. Who do you go to? Your options are Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Knox, Edmund Randolph.
If it's with Britain, I probably want to send Hamilton. I don't want to send Jefferson there.
Yes, exactly. Oh, my God, Kyle. Right on. So he walks over to Jefferson, and he's like, hey, Secretary of State, what do you think I should do? And Thomas Jefferson, who loves France and absolutely hates everything about the British, is like, do you know what we should do? Let's side with the French and fight the British. I don't know if that's what he actually said, but that was like what Washington was like. All right, well, next, excuse me, Mr. Hamilton. And Mr. Hamilton's like, hey, what's up, boss? And he's like, I got a question for you. You know your buddy John Jay? He's like, yeah. He seems to be like a good, he understands the cause of the Americans, seems like a good guy. I know he's pro-British, but he's the Chief Justice. I know it's separation of powers, but can we maybe talk to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? Which is also baller. Like, think imagine, like, if Roberts just went and negotiated, like, the end of the Ukraine-Russian war. Like, big wow.
Right.
Baller as hell, man. So,
but, I mean, the roles were kind of still a little blurred back then.
Yeah. So they call up old Johnny J, and they're like, hey, John, can you go over to, can you go negotiate with the Brits on this? And John J is like, yeah, sure. So he goes... He goes, Jefferson's like super angry. It's like, what are you doing? Why are you sending the guy who likes like the British over there? That's crazy. And Washington's like, we're trying not to fight a war. Like, we'll fight a war, but like, I don't like, we're kind of a new country. We're finally back on our feet. Can we not have like a massive war?
Yeah.
And honestly, Hamilton and Jefferson didn't like each other at this point already. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody like Jefferson?
Dude, I don't really. I don't. I can't think of somebody who liked Jefferson. Burr and like mm-hmm. Southerners in the, like 1960. I
think those. Yeah. Yeah.
that's like probably not true, but like also probably those groups definitely love him. I mean, you got to separate the man from the policy, but even then.
Yeah. Even then, from the little bit of research I've been doing, I've not been impressed with his policy choices either. But. That's for another time.
That's an interesting point. We should highlight that in the Google Talk. We should go down that road a little bit.
Yeah.
So Jay, so the treaty ends up being crazy unpopular with the American public, but it actually did pretty good through the Senate. Mm-hmm. It was 20-10 votes to get it through. Everybody crapped on John Jay about it not working. He had no bargaining power, and they'd already moved their military again, and he avoided war. For research purposes, can I read you off what he got from the Brits?
Yeah.
All right. So in the treaty, it's titled Additional Rights. All right. That, dead mm-hmm. serious. That's what they call it. They go, Additional Rights. He secured the surrender of the Northwestern Posts. So that's all those forts they went back into in Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, places like that. Mm-hmm. So they all left. A commercial treaty with England that granted the U.S. most favored nation status. So they got whatever trade, yep, whatever trade agreement, they always got either that or better.
The best.
Like, I'm not done yet. Remember, this was seen as unpopular and not good for the economy. But he traded that for restricted access to the British West Indies. Which seems like an okay trade. It's like, hey, do you want the best trade deal? You're an exporter. You are exporting things. Why do you need access to
right.
places that you tend to import things from? He settled the Canadian main border, that Engle Adams dispute I mentioned earlier. Settled that.
Yeah.
Got compensation for debts incurred by the Brits prior to the colonies becoming free.
What? Are you serious?
He got all the American ships that were seized, and all the people who were on the boats released.
How did he manage to do that with no leverage?
The one part that I will say, I get this is what ticked people off. He conceded that the Brits, that would remain undefined about privateering. Mm-hmm. In the future. So that's why we eventually did have the War of 1812. But he did create this discussion. They couldn't take soldiers, but they could still impress, like, you know, I'm trying to word
this. If you were a privateer or a piracy vessel, they could capture your vessel and
right.
impress you into service.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you were under a U.S. flag and the ships and the goods were bound for France, mm-hmm. they could be seized, right? That was the whole thing.
Okay. So they were It sounds like Britain was more concerned about what was going on with France than us, and they were just trying to stop France from gaining an ally. This is kind of the way I take it.
Yes. But there's a little piece of the Jay Treaty about that whole... Because the Jay Treaty, the only time I really heard it was talked about in school, is like relative to it being a failure, a form of appeasement prior to 1812. And I'm like, not really, but kind of. Mm.
That doesn't sound like it to me.
There's one thing that I will say it's not appeasement, because there's a clause in there that gets glossed over. They could seize U.S. goods on U.S. ships bound for France. Everybody's like, okay, they could. Nobody ever reads past that. Mm-hmm. They had to pay for the goods. Oh, England had to pay for the goods they seized. I'm like, that's just trade.
Yes. Oh, man, that's like a free sale.
And then if the French were, if there was French goods coming back on American ships, they could seize the French goods. But I'm like, this, people think we lost this.
I don't think seized is the right word in that scenario. That
buy.
Yes, they have their first right of refusal, yeah. I guess we call that. I'm like,
okay, so you gave us back all our stuff. You gave us the best trade deal possible in perpetuity. You conceded all the borders. You left all the forts you were supposed to leave that you hadn't left. All right, good. And you get first right refusal to our French goods.
Yeah. And you gave us access to the West Indies.
Yes. And they're like, it's restricted access. I'm like, yeah, but it's still a form of access.
Yeah. How much access do we have before?
We were pretty much just getting all our crap stolen all the time. So I guess anything's fine.
Yes.
And I'm like, and this really had nothing. I mean, did it have something to do with the War of 1812? Yes, of course it did. Everything has to do with something to some degree. But I'm like, that's not John. John Jay did a great job. I feel like that dude should
have credit. No, he freaking crushed that. Yeah.
Yeah, big John Jay fan. And he had no leverage.
That's the most impressive thing. How do you
poker face his way through that?
That guy deserves his own state. Do we give like one of the old ones that maybe just deserves a better name? Like,
I'm just thinking like the cardinal direction states. Like we should rename those.
The cardinal direction
states. Like J Dakota.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, J Dakota. What would you call South Dakota?
Dude, I'm a huge Hamilton fan. Hamilton, give him, Dakota.
Well, he's already got the $100 bill. I mean, come on.
No, he only has the 10. I wish he had the 100.
Oh, wait. God damn it. Cut that.
Cut that, yeah.
You sound like a complete fucking idiot.
No, I had to think about that for a minute. And I was like, that's fucking Franklin.
Yeah.
So
wait, that's Franklin, yeah. All right, but I think that is... God damn, that's quite the ride, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean... I wrote a lot. Dude, this whole...
Well, we got a whole another episode we can do.
These are all just Jay.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And we didn't even get to the other one. That was two of your items on your list.
Yes.
But I think we did get through most of the important stuff, especially about Washington. So I'd say that's like, what, one down and 39 to go?
Yeah, right. We got through National Bank. We got through the state debts. We got through, the Tariff Act that played into the Jay Treaty.
Yeah.
We got to the Funding Act as, what do you call it? Oh, that's the one I forgot. It's the National Infrastructure under Washington.
Well, we've got another episode next week, our last one to wrap it up. So maybe we could put a pin on that and talk about it then.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I went way off the rails on the Jay Treaty because it's actually funny.
I think that was the most fascinating conversation we've had so far. That was one of the most impressive displays of negotiation I think I've ever seen.
Poker face just went through it.
It's the goddamn.
And the people were pissed at it. They're like, oh yeah, this sucks.
Alright, well, I mean, let us know how you think we did. Leave a comment, drop us a line, chinashopproductions@gmail.com. Next week we'll be back to review just everything that we've learned and to issue our final grades on the president's legacy. Remember to check out our website, thebuckstartsherepodcast.com, and we'll see you all next week.